At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media, LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
So I grew up like with another dual identity. It wasn't just black and white, but also a dual religious identity. I grew up in a black church environment, but when I went to college, I joined a white evangelical church. So I tell people I knew my James Cone, I knew the black spirituals, but also I knew my C.S. Lewis and, you know, my Francis Schaeffer. So it's like these two worlds.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. I'm delighted today to welcome to our show John Blake. He is an award-winning CNN journalist. He's been honored by the Associated Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Academy of Religion, the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Religion Communicators Council. He's a recipient of the GLAAD Media Award. He has spoken at high schools, colleges, and symposiums, and in documentaries on race, religion, and politics. He's a native of Baltimore, Maryland. We're speaking today about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. John Blake, welcome to Things Not Seen.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to start our conversation in a bit of an odd place. I'm going to take us back to 1910 and a law that gets passed in Baltimore, Maryland about the zoning of residential real estate. If you could briefly walk us through what that law was and how it began to affect the neighborhood that you grew up in.
So around 1910, the Baltimore City Council passed the nation's first racially restrictive housing covenant. And it banned or it would not allow Black and Jewish residents to live in certain neighborhoods in Baltimore. And that led to Baltimore becoming, like a lot of cities throughout the North, extremely racially segregated. Blacks just couldn't buy homes into white neighborhoods with what we call redlining. And the reason I mentioned that in the book is that when people think of racial segregation and Jim Crow segregation, they think of the South. And one of the things I was trying to do in my book is to point out that I grew up in the Jim Crow North, that racism and racial segregation was very pronounced in cities like Baltimore. And if you want to understand why Baltimore, like specifically West Baltimore, where I grew up, the Black neighborhood, where, you know, where the uprisings and the violence and the wire, if you want to understand how my neighborhood degenerated, you have to go into the past. You have to look at these laws that were passed, all these bureaucratic decisions that were made behind the scenes. And you just can't focus on the easy arguments like culture, pathology in the inner city and tired arguments like that. So I tried to put that kind of context throughout the book to explain the world I grew up in.
Thank you for that. And I want to stress to listeners that when we're talking about West Baltimore, because of these laws that were passed in the early part of the 20th century and continued to have effects rippling through the time of your birth and your growing up, your encounter with whiteness in the neighborhood sense, you say it was either oppression or authority, but you didn't have very many relationships with individual white persons. Is that a fair way of characterizing your experience growing up, or would you say it in a different way?
No, it is a fair way. I say that I grew up as a closeted biracial person. What I mean by that is I grew up in this all-Black world, racially segregated world of West Baltimore. And I grew up knowing that I had a white mother, but she vanished from my life not long after I was born. And all that I knew was nobody told me why she disappeared. They just told us, your mother's name is Shirley, she's white, and her family hates Black people. One of the challenges I had in my neighborhood was that pretty much everybody hated white people. So what do you do when you grow up as a young man in that time when there's no Obamas, there's no biracial role models like Kamala Harris? I was ashamed of having a white mother, and I was angry at white people. And I never saw any white people in my neighborhood. It was extremely racially segregated. During my entire time in public school, from Head Start to the 12th grade, I only saw one white student in any of my schools. And what I was trying to point out in my book is that wasn't accidental. That was deliberate. And it created a lot of problems that we still see in Baltimore today.
Now we're beginning to turn to your book more than I imagined. And I can't say enough good things about this book. It is part detective story, part ghost story, part redemption story. It weaves all of these different themes and genres together. And at the center of it is a young man having experiences and having no one around him, at least in his youth, giving him any answers or any feedback about the experiences that he's having, other than just shut up and take it. My heart broke for you as the central character of this story again and again and again. Let's begin to dig into that. You mentioned growing up in West Baltimore, a heavily segregated area of a northern city of the Jim Crow North, and having this closeted identity. And part of what your closeted identity was, you had an African-American father whom you knew and a white mother whom was a mystery to you. And maybe begin to tell us a little bit about your experience growing up with your father and help my listeners understand what that was like.
So my father was an incredible character. And by the way, I love the way you described the book, part detective story, part redemption story. When I remember writing a book, I was like, golly, there's so many big themes in there. How do I fit this in there? But yeah, my father was, like my mother, somebody who was willing to defy convention. So when I was born in 1964, interracial marriage was illegal in Maryland and in much of the country. But that didn't prevent him from openly going to try to date my mom and dealing with the racism from my family and being the father of two biracial sons. He just didn't care about conventions. And he was a merchant marine. And I think that's part of the key to understanding why he acted the way he did. There's a kind of a character in Black literature that the crazy Black person doesn't care what white people think and will take risks that other Black people don't take. And my father was that person. And I think one of the reasons he was that person is because he had joined a merchant marine when he was 17 during World War II. So he had spent most of his life sailing across the world. And what I said in my book is that in the mid-20th century, there was no more integrated space than the deck of a merchant marine ship. When he was on those ships with white men, yes, he dealt with racism, but not the type of virulent racism that we see stateside. So when you're at sea with white sailors and brown sailors, it doesn't matter the man's color. It's like, who can you rely on for your life? So he grew up in that world. And I think that gave him a kind of a freedom and a boldness to do the things he did, to seek out my mom, to not care what people think. But yeah, he's an incredible character.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with John Blake, an award-winning CNN journalist. We're talking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. I loved how you described this in your book, More Than I Imagined, because you helped us understand that your father, when he was on that ship, as you just said, he was part of an integrated community long before America began to integrate. And I began to have sympathy for him, even though he did some things where he would almost abandon you and your brother Pat when you were young to like other family members or even to strangers. But I began to understand his reasoning for doing that, because it was much easier for him to be at sea and to be who he was than to be on the shores of America and be who he was. Now, is my sympathy misplaced? Am I letting your father off the hook too easily? Or am I really understanding your own growing way of interacting with and thinking about the complexity of your father?
No, I think you're describing him very well. It was hard for him to be stateside. He was accustomed to living with a certain type of freedom. And when he went overseas, he didn't have to deal with people calling him the N-word, telling him he had to sit at a certain place in the bus and things like that. And I think he was accustomed to that. But I think also my father, he came up in a generation born during a depression where I think he didn't really know how to talk to us and explain to us the absence of our mom, why she was gone, why her white family members wanted nothing to do with us. It was something beyond him. He was like this kind of a working class, rough kind of guy who loved to drink and hit the bars. Talking to these young biracial boys about these kind of complex racial issues was too much for him. So I think it's much easier for him and frankly more fun for him to be overseas at that time. But I knew when he came home, I knew he loved us. He spent all this time with us. And I never doubted that for a minute. He taught me a lot of lessons about courage. I think one of the most important things he taught me is that despite some of the racism he experienced from my mother's family and that he experienced that any Black man would have growing up in the era, I never heard him use a racial slur talking about white people. I never heard him put all white people into one category. And I think part of that, again, was his experience in making white friends on a ship, traveling the world. I think it just gave him this perspective and it prevented him from having this consuming bitterness that really afflicted a lot of Black people at the time and frankly this time today as well.
There's one particular scene from your youth growing up with your father that really stayed with me. And at one point, he gets you and your brother, Pat, up, and he's there with a record player. And he's like, we're going to learn this song from, I believe it was Nat King Cole. And what was particular about that is it was a song that was explicitly about love. And I wonder if you could just bring us back to that memory right quick.
Yeah. So when my father came home, he was overseas probably about 9 months out of the year. So when he came home, it was like Santa Claus was coming. And we were just so happy. We were out of these foster homes we were staying in. And one of the ways that he would show his love is that he would spend all his time with us. He would just play baseball with us, play ping pong with us, take us down to the Union Hall. But he also loved Nat King Cole and singing Nat King Cole songs. And I put that scene in there early in the book to show, yes, he had problems. Yes, he abandoned us in certain ways, but he also showed us love. And that little scene of him singing that Nat King Cole song with us, I wanted to establish that he was much more complex than I realized. And I knew he loved me. And it was weird. Like I said, I can still remember the lyrics to that song even today because it meant so much to me.
But there was another side to this relationship as well, and that is, he would oftentimes leave without much explanation or even without any warning. And there's another scene that stays with me where you're young and you're aware that the time is coming for him to leave again. And you try and stay up all night to stop him and you fall asleep and you wake up the next morning and he's gone. And I wonder if you could take us back to that kind of moment as well.
Yeah, that would break my heart because just think of it. I'm this biracial kid hiding my identity in West Baltimore growing up. And I don't know anything about my mom or her family. So all I have is my father. And I knew I could tell when he was about to leave for the ship. And I would always try to stay up to prevent him from leaving because that meant going back to the foster homes. And I just remember I would say, I'm going to stay up all night. He's not going to sneak out because he would always leave 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I would try to stay up, try to keep myself awake, but I couldn't. And I would fall asleep. And as soon as I would awaken, I would run down the hallway to his door. I would open his door, his bedroom, and everything's gone. His duffel bag, his cigarettes, all that. But I can still smell them. I can still smell the Old Spice cologne, the Pall Mall cigarettes. And that just made me feel so alone in the world. And I knew it would be probably about 6 or 7 months before I would see him again. And I would have to go back to the foster homes. So that was part of the struggle that I had at that time.
And as we're moving towards our first break, I'm staying with this and thinking about this image of the father who sits you down and helps you learn Nat King Cole songs about love, the father who disappears without warning. it's clear that he was struggling with a lot that he couldn't name, and he couldn't even begin to imagine what a life for you and your brother might be like. And so I'm wondering, as you're looking back at that time, how do you think your father thought about you and your brother, Pat? I know that he was proud of you. That rings out in the book. But what are some other things that that you think back to at that time that maybe he was imagining for you and your brother?
Well, I can tell you exactly. I remember when I told him later in my life, I was like, Dad, I'm thinking about writing a book about growing up. And he was confused. He said, what are you going to write about? I said, well, I was thinking about writing about some of the racial issues I experienced, not knowing my mother's family or her family rejecting me, not knowing her. And he was just so confused. He said, but you didn't have any racial issues growing up. And truly, he was not an introspective person at all. He was a man of action. He was the type of person, for example, he spent much of his time in war zones, in World War II, Korea, Vietnam. He was in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive of 68. He was there in 75 when the last American ships sailed out. And he missed it. He loved that. So he didn't understand the world, the things that I was trying to deal with, trying to understand. It was just beyond him. And so I couldn't really talk to him about those things because it was beyond him.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with John Blake. He's an award-winning CNN journalist. He has been honored by the Associated Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Academy of Religion, and numerous other organizations. Today, we're speaking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. We'll be back in just a moment.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture. LitPress books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with John Blake. He's an award-winning CNN journalist. He's been honored by the Associated Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Academy of Religion, the National Association of Black Journalists, and numerous other organizations. Today, we're talking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. Well, in the first segment, we have been talking about your childhood growing up in West Baltimore, a heavily segregated city in the northern Jim Crow experience. And we also talked a bit about your father, who was part of the Merchant Marine and was a loving father, but also was a father who didn't have ways of really speaking to you and your brother about the experiences you were having as biracial youth and would occasionally disappear without warning to go on a ship for 6 or 9 months at a time. But now let's shift a bit and begin to talk about your mother. And I mentioned at the outset that this book, More Than I Imagined, reads in multiple genres, but one of the genres is detective story. In over your life as a child and even into your adolescence and your early 20s, you were piecing together bits about your mother, who was white, but you didn't know anything else about her other than that particular demographic fact. So begin to talk us through, as a child, what you imagined your mother was and who you imagined your mother was.
I'd be honest, as a child, I tried not to think too much about her because every time I did, my heart would ache. I would like, why does she not want me? Why does not her family does not want to know me? And what made it worse is I had no idea how she looked. There was no picture of her. I had no memory of her. There was no sound of her voice. It was like she was a phantom. It was very strange. And so I tried not to think about her. And I was fortunate in that I had an aunt who became as kind of a surrogate mom who really stepped up, and it just became that source of stability that I really needed. But my mom, I try not to think about it because it would just make me lonely. And it would also make me very angry, because what happened is that the anger that I had at my mom and her family blending in with the general anger at white people that everybody in my neighborhood had. And so it was very strange. I remember in high school, I read a story about a black man who had taken a wrong turn in New York, and he was attacked by a white mob. He had driven into this white neighborhood and they had beaten him to death. And I remember going out to my porch and looking up my street, all black neighborhood. And again, the context is my neighborhood is infamous. This is where the setting for the HBO series, The Wire, this is where the Freddie Gray protest happened. But I remember thinking, like, what would I do if a white person walked through my neighborhood? And I remember thinking I would have to hurt them, that they don't belong here. And I'm saying this with a white mom. So all that, you know, to answer your question, that absence from my mom, the absence of my mom, just, I try not to think about it, but when I did, it just built up anger and hurt.
And I'm going to jump ahead for just a moment, because there's a scene later when you're attending as a freshman Howard University, and you are sitting with your roommate and you swap yearbooks from your high school. And you, if I recall, your roommate is from Denver, Colorado. Talk to us about that particular moment and what that scene began to open up for you in terms of this sort of notion of, if I saw a white person, I'd have to hurt him kind of thinking.
Well, the scene with the roommate in a historically black college I went to, Howard University, was key, because it was kind of weird, an irony. It's when I went to a black college that I started to begin to realize how important it was to be in racially integrated settings. It was the strangest thing. Because I would meet all these really fascinating, smart black students. People like Kamala Harris was at Howard at the same time I was. We had the same friends. I never met her, but I knew her. I knew her boyfriend. I knew her. I knew the person she beat when she ran for student union president. But I remember looking at these yearbooks of these black students that came from, a lot of them came from the South and all, and I saw these schools that look like college campuses, all the resources they had. I saw all these pictures of them smiling next to white students. And I began to realize they had a much better education, a more well-rounded world that they grew up in, because they had been around white people. And it wasn't just being around white people. It was being near those resources that white students had. And that's when I began to talk about that there was this period in our country's history that hardly anybody knows about, from like the mid-70s to around 1988, when we really tried to integrate schools, and it's seen as a failure. That's too simplistic. For a lot of people, it really helped. These people I met at Howard, these black students, they were the beneficiaries of this kind of golden period, because test scores, black students really rose dramatically in that period. And the white test scores did not suffer as a result. So we were coming together. It was working. But then that door closed. So in a sense, those black students I met at Howard showed me how deprived my background was. And it also was this kind of sad situation, because they were walking through this door that was already closing, because we were going to retreat from these integrated schools around that time. So yeah, that just seeing those yearbooks, it blew me away.
Now, what I want my listeners to grasp is the complexity and dimensions that we're talking about here. So your father was the beneficiary of a more integrated merchant marine than the experience he could have on dry land. Your fellow classmates at Howard University were the beneficiaries of this kind of golden period, as you describe it, where they were given access to resources and proximity to whiteness gave them real opportunities. And you yourself are self-described biracial. Your mother is coded as white, and yet you are struggling and saying, I don't want to talk about my whiteness. There's one point where even in your early years where you say to your father, don't refer to me anymore as your biracial child, I'm black. Tell me a little bit about that moment.
I told my father that because I resented having to think about race so much and at such an early age. I just, like kids, I just wanted to fit in and be like everybody else. Like today, to be biracial is like cool. It's almost like you're a symbol of this new America. But in the world I grew up in, that wasn't the case. So I just resented thinking about race all the time. And I resented my white family that had rejected me. So I didn't want any kind of reminder of them. And so that's why I told them that.
Well, now let's turn to your mother, because she was a mystery through your childhood. And then it's almost like at one moment, as you're moving towards adulthood, a light switch gets flipped and suddenly your father shows you a picture and says, this is your mother. And there's another point where you have an opportunity to actually go, you and your brother Pat, and meet her. Talk to us a little bit about how it changed from her being a mystery to beginning to get some information about her, even though you still don't know the full story.
Well, yeah, the sequence is this. When I was 17, my father just called me into his bedroom one day and said, do you want to meet your mom? And that was like dropping a bomb on me, because I didn't even know she was alive. If anybody in her family was alive. And of course, I said yes, because I was curious. And when I met her, it's important to know the place. Where I walked into a place, and I still didn't quite know where I was walking into. It was this huge red brick building that looked like a military barracks. And I could hear people moaning in pain in the background while others were like crying and like laughing hysterically. And I walked into this waiting room and my mom comes out. And as I begin to talk to her and I look at my surroundings, I realize my mom is in a mental institution. She's suffering from a severe form of mental illness called schizophrenia. And when I see her, that's my shock. Nobody told us, even on the day we were driven out there with my younger brother, Patrick, that your mom had a mental illness. We made that discovery right when we met her and nobody prepared us. So that was a shock. But that meeting was important for another reason that I can only glimpse at the time. When I saw my mom in that place and I saw her condition, that was a notorious mental institution. They had mistreated patients, chained them to the bed, put them through medical experiments. When I realized that she had been staying in this place for 17, 16 years, it was the first time in my life that I felt empathy for white people. I thought that only Black people could really understand what it meant to be treated a certain way for the way you were born, treated with contempt, brutalized, discriminated against. But when I saw my mom in her state, I was like, wow, we don't have a monopoly on suffering. I've never seen a Black person suffer like that. So that began to change something in me, began to shift my racial attitude. So I not only saw her in a new way, I started to see white people in a new way. And again, it came through personal contact, relationships.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with John Blake. He's an award-winning CNN journalist. Today, we're talking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. So you have this moment where your brother Pat and you are taken to, without explanation, pretty much, this building looks like a military barracks, and you begin to discover, partly by hearing the moans, but also by looking in some of the doorways of the cells at some of the people who are in there, that your mother is in a mental institution. Now, listeners, from that data point, they might get a certain notion of how the story of your father and your mother unfolded. But one thing that really struck me, and I want to check with you to make sure that I read this right, my sense from your descriptions of your mother's and father's interactions when you had the chance to see them interact, there was genuine love between them through their whole lives. Did I read that right, or would you say that in a different way?
No, that was very true, because it was something I doubted for the first half of my life. I wondered if my father really loved my mom. And I wondered if he loved her or if he loved her whiteness. Was he a Black man who was just drawn to a taboo relationship? But as I got to know my father, I discovered that all those years that she had been isolated, exiled to these mental institutions, he had been visiting her on a regular basis, keeping her, helping her out, checking on her, giving her things, helping her. He stayed in contact with her. He made her feel loved. And I never knew that. He never told me. I just found this out through other people. So that was a pattern I saw with my father. Again, he didn't talk about things. He just did them. But he was very loving to my mom. And there's a great scene in the book where I see them interact and I see the affection. I see how comfortable she is with him. And the only way she could be so comfortable with him is because he had stayed in contact with her. he had showed her that he loved her.
Well, and one of the things that also struck me about this is there's another scene in the book where it's not initially clear that your mother's mental health is deteriorating, but your father began to discover sort of aberrant behaviors, some things that she was doing with her hygiene and things like that. But there was one particular moment where he comes home and he finds out that you have actually been harmed by your mother. And in that moment, and how this is, she had a lit cigarette and she, to try and get you to stop crying, you described that she stubbed it out on your chest and you still have the scar to this day. It was in that moment that your father made the decision that your mother had to go away. And I imagine, as you've built these characters for me, that must have been a heartbreaking decision for your father. Does that sound like the right description, or would you describe it in a different way?
No, it is heartbreaking because my father was very well equipped to deal with racism. When my parents went out in public and police officers would stop them, people would make fun of him, he would get arrested, they would get assaulted. He and my mom could deal with that because they were such strong people. He was totally unprepared to deal with mental illness because nobody talked about it then. Nobody knew what was coming. And so it was heartbreaking for him to have these two sons with this young woman that he loved, that he would have to give that up. And I think about my mom, only older do I get it. Just think about it. You're a young white mom. You've defied your family and convention. You've given birth to two young sons. And soon as you, not long after you give birth, you're taken away from them. What is that like for a mom to be ripped from your children and you can't see them? You can't talk to them for years. You can't write them. And that must have been so hard for her too. So yeah, I thought it was racism that broke him up, but it was really not being able to deal with mental illness.
Now, as your relationship with your mother began to deepen and you began to visit and interact, how did your relationship with your father change after that point, or did it?
It changed because I began to see he had so much more depth than I realized. And that the main thing is I could see that he loved my mom. I remember one time when my father took us to see our mom. He was sitting at the kitchen table. My brother Patrick was with me. And we're just listening to him. And I look at Pat's face and he has this huge, silly grin on his face. I'm like, what does he find funny? But then I realized that I had the same silly grin on my face. I looked so happy. And I realized it was like the first time we ever seen them together. And we just felt so happy just to see our mother and father together. So yeah, he loved my mom and he showed it through his actions. He wasn't the type of person to talk about things. And I would just learn about things that he did for her later from other people.
And I hope I'm not giving away too much to say to listeners that as we proceed in the book, you end up having a relationship with both your father and your mother until late into both of their lives. And that is a beautiful thing to see. But I want to shift gears for a moment and ask, not only your mother, but also your mother's family begins to become revealed to you at this point. And you have to overcome some assumptions that you make about them as well. I wonder if you could walk us briefly through some of the changes in your understanding of your mother's family that you encountered.
So before I began to meet members of my mother's family, I had this vision of racism that I would call this. I thought that you're either a racist or you're not. There's no in between. And when I began to meet members of my mother's family, I saw that racism, how they denied racism, though they used the N-word, though they said that white and black people should be kept apart. I saw that. But at the same time, I saw people who had this capacity to grow, to forgive, to be empathetic, to be loving kindness. And that was the first time, like I say, you could put those two things into one person. And that was key for me to see that in them. I saw that most of all in my mother's sister, you know, Aunt Mary. She demonstrated an incredible amount of grace in the way she changed from what I saw when I met her to what she is now. And that's one of my favorite parts of the story.
And this actually takes up a good part of the arc of the story. The way that your Aunt Mary was described to you was she's a racist. She's vocal about her hatred of Black people. And when you first met her, that was the person that you expected to encounter. But over time, you develop a relationship both face to face, but also through letters, where you begin to learn a much greater complexity there. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. And this is key, what you're saying, David. What changed her, what changed me, it was relationships. It was contact. And it was a weird thing. I began to meet my mother's family and try to build relationships with them while I was also becoming a journalist who writes about race. And those two were coming clashing because in my world as a journalist, facts are everything. If you give people information, they will change. I wrote all these stories about racism. I covered things like Charlottesville, Baltimore, election of Trump. And we thought if we present these facts, people will change. If we show all these videos of Black people unarmed, being brutalized and murdered, a critical mass of white people will shift and there will be racial transformation in the country. It's about facts. But what I experienced in my personal life as this biracial man trying to make a connection with this white family who never accepted me is that facts didn't matter. It's the thing that changed people, relationships. And that's why I say facts don't change people, relationships do. And I think people who are in the anti-racist community forget that. Yes, policy and protests are vital, but you have to make space for interracial communities, interracial relationships, where people get to know each other time after time, year after year. That's also when change happens. And that's indispensable. And I think we've forgotten that. And I say that not because I read it in a book. It's what I experienced with my Aunt Mary, what she was and what she is now. It just came to the give and take of relationships, getting to know people when they stop becoming a category and they become a person. And then that's what she became to me.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with John Blake. He's an award-winning CNN journalist, and he's been honored by numerous press associations. Today, we're talking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with John Blake. He's an award-winning CNN journalist. He's been honored by the Associated Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Academy of Religion, the National Association of Black Journalists, and numerous other professional organizations. Today, we're talking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew. Before the break, we were talking about your growing relationship over many years with your mother's sister, your Aunt Mary. And you talked about the way that she was when you first met her, which was she had hardened racist notions, and how she grew. And you made the point that this happened through relationships, and particularly a relationship with you. I wonder if you have any kind of representative stories or examples to help my listeners understand what you mean.
Yeah. So when I first met Aunt Mary, she was a different person. And I remember asking her at the beginning of our relationship, why didn't you reach out to me or my brother Patrick when we were younger? Was it because we're Black? And she said, no, it had nothing to do with race. It was because you were a Catholic, which I totally did not buy because I knew about the racism of her family, all that. So that created just tremendous anger in me. And for a long time, I just kept my talks with her for a minimum. Then something happened to me one day where I had what I call my own racial reckoning. And it was in the strangest place. It was in a Lowe's improvement store. I went to a Lowe's store one morning to get some paint for my deck. There was a Black and a white man behind the counter. The Black man was not busy, but the white man was on the phone. I waited for about 5 minutes until the white man got off the phone and then went up to him and asked for the proper paint color, ignoring the Black man. Took the paint home. Started using it on my deck and realized that he had given me the wrong paint, and then it hit me. I just racially profiled a Black man. And here I am. You go in my library at home, you can see all these books from Kendi and Robert DiAngelo. But I did it in that millisecond. I did that. And then all of a sudden, I thought about, wow, if I can do this, that shows you how powerful racism is. With my background, I should have a little bit more compassion on Aunt Mary. So I did something I had never done before. I went upstairs to my bedroom, where I kept all these letters Aunt Mary had written to me over the years. I never opened most of them. Opened them up. And I began to read them. And she was totally different than what I expected. I always wanted an apology from her, for her to say, yes, it was because you were Black. And when I opened up those letters, everything I wanted from her was in there. She apologized for not reaching out to me because I was Black. She confessed that she grew up in this all-white world where no one talked about racism. She said, if you don't want to talk to me, if you hate me, I understand. But I want to have a relationship with you. She was so gracious. She was so forgiving. And that just started this whole, it changed our relationship. And I was like, why did she change like that? And I didn't even see it. But I think part of the change is because we had this relationship. And it was, I think it was also something where we had a relationship where we just didn't talk about race all the time. There was a larger common purpose, and that was to take care of my mom. And over that period of time, we became family. And I never would have expected that.
Well, and part of this journey, and you mentioned just the edge of it when you said that your mother's family had, when you asked your Aunt Mary, did you reject us because we were Black? And her answer was, no, it was because you weren't Catholic. You grew up adjacent to Christianity. I remember from your book that one of your early reading experiences was to read the Bible that was there in your house, just snippets of it. And then you had relatives who would, or people in your life that would come and you'd hear them singing hymns or you'd hear them praying over you. But you yourself were not identifying as Christian, if I read you correctly, through your youth. And it wasn't until you got to Howard University that that began to shift. And I wonder if you could briefly walk us through what changed from your understanding of God and religion as a child to when you began to have a relationship not only with other people, but with the Creator.
It's a good question. So I grew up like with another dual identity. It wasn't just Black and white, but also a dual religious identity. I grew up in a Black church environment. But when I went to college, I joined a white evangelical church. So I tell people I knew my James Cone, I knew the Black spirituals, but also I knew my C.S. Lewis and, you know, my Francis Schaeffer. So it's like these two worlds. But what converted me was when this young man at Howard University, a gentleman named Darren, introduced me to his church. He would just knock on my dorm door wanting to talk about the Bible all the time. So I just said, let me just go to this church and just shut him up. And when I went into that church, I saw something I had never really seen before. I saw Black, white, and brown people hugging each other, calling each other brother and sister, going to each other's homes past Sunday, having pizza, being friends. And I tell people, that was what converted me. All this stuff about the cross, redemption, the Savior, atonement, that meant nothing to me. But when I saw an interracial community where people were really loving one another, coming from the environment and experience I had, that was pivotal. I was like, this stuff is real. And that's a big reason why I became a Christian.
Well, I want to go deeper with this. And I want to tie it back to something that we talked about earlier in the conversation. When your father was on the Merchant Marine ships, those ships were integrated in part because you couldn't go anywhere else. You were dependent on every person that was on that boat, and you really had no other choice. Communities in America, religious communities, they have lots of other choices. They're not forced to be on a ship together and have to do integrated things together. So what is it, do you think, that allowed for these types of communities that you began to frequent, these integrated Christian communities? What is it that made them do this when they weren't forced to, like the Merchant Marine ships were?
My experience has been this, and I've been in a lot of interracial church. You have to have leadership that really believes in it and sets the tone. Otherwise, it won't happen because the natural human tendency is to racially segregate. The natural human tendency is just not even racially segregate, to be around people that are more similar to you. So it has to start from the top. But to answer your question, why did they do it? What I saw is that they saw this as an accurate reflection of what we're supposed to be as Christians. When they say, look at the book of Acts, look at Jesus. Jesus reached out to all sorts of people, to centurions, Samaritan woman. He broke down cultural, ethnic barriers. We have to do the same as Christians. Look at the book of Acts, Gentiles, you know, all these different types of people, Jews, all these people colliding. They said that's why the church grew, because it was so different. It had all these different types of people together under a common purpose. So they saw that you have to do it if you're going to be an authentic Christian witness. This is part of being a Christian. Segregated churches should be an oxymoron. So that's what I experienced. But I got to add this. There's a huge difference between a racially mixed church and a racially integrated church. And so I think that's really important to know, too.
Well, could you talk to us about how you make that distinction? What's the difference between a racially mixed church and a racially integrated church? Help us understand that.
Okay. So I've been in interracial churches where black and white and brown people sat in the pews. Okay. That's a racially mixed church. But if you looked at the stage, who were the people on the pulpit? They were all white. If you looked at the worship hymns and the sermons, they were European. They had a certain cultural influence that did not reflect black or brown people. That's racially mixed. A racially integrated church is totally different. Racially integrated church is where black and brown and white people not only share pews, but they share powers. Black people and brown people in the pulpit, women in positions of power. You sing songs that are not only reflective of, say, a European tradition, but say African or Latin. That's what I experienced. Because I've been in racially mixed churches where they just didn't last. The same thing that happened to certain neighborhoods where when a certain ratio of black people passed a certain ratio in the congregation would tip and it would become either all black, all white. That happened. I've seen it happen. But in these racially integrated churches, I think they have more lasting power because you feel like as a black or a brown person that your culture is acknowledged. And that's the difference. And I think it's really important.
And I want to crystallize this for our listeners, because you give an example of a church that you had a relationship with a number of years, Oakhurst Presbyterian in a neighborhood of East Atlanta, run by a pastor named Nibs Stroop. And one of the things that, well, two things stand out to me about your description of Oakhurst Presbyterian. One is a sort of famous, infamous story that gets told at Oakhurst about a phone call between Nibs Stroop and a congregant leader by the name of Inez, and she calls him out on his racism, and instead of becoming defensive, Nibs says, "Well, you're right," and Inez says, "Now that you've acknowledged that, we can begin to work together, because as long as you're aware that you're there and this, we can begin to build a relationship." The other piece about that experience with Oakhurst Presbyterian Church that stuck out to me was when you sat down with Nibs Stroop for the first time and you had a long conversation. And at the end, Pastor Stroop said, "Let's do this again." And in both of those, I hear a kind of exactly what you're saying, not a call to put you in a category or to put the leadership in a category, but a call from the leadership to the congregation, let's be in relationship and let's learn how to do this together. Now, these are all my words, not yours. As I'm saying this back to you, have I got it right or would you say it in a different way?
No, I think you have it right. I would just add this. There's this belief that if you're going to have a successful multiracial congregation, you should try to avoid conflict. And when people wrote about Oakhurst when I was there, a lot of journals tend to say, "We didn't have this conflict. We were like this rainbow nation where everybody got along. Isn't that beautiful?" No, we had tremendous conflict. There were tremendous arguments behind the scene. But what I've seen is that conflict was actually a sign of health, because people got stuff out in the open. They talked openly. People could disagree with the pastor and say, "You're wrong. That's racist." And he wouldn't flee the church. Everything was out in the open. And I felt I was very healthy, much healthier than these other places where they say, "Look, black and white and brown people in the pews, isn't that great?" But they don't really talk about issues that are simmering beneath the surface.
Now, it is clear to me from reading your book and from this portion of our conversation that you take your faith very seriously. It is an integral part of who you are and who you understand yourself to be. So I hope that you'll allow me to ask this question. How does your faith impact your work as a journalist? Does it ever get in the way? Do you ever feel like you have to hide it or put it in the closet? Or does it augment your work as a journalist and bring you a further dimension that maybe your colleagues don't necessarily have access to? How would you describe your faith in relationship to your work in your vocation?
No one's ever asked me that before. For me, it's not been a barrier, because I've never seen my role as a journalist to convert people. I think it was Huston Smith. I don't know.
Not sure.
Anyway, he said something where he says, "I'm the type of Christian where God is defined by Jesus, but not confined to Jesus." So I never felt Christianity was the only way. They'd say Gandhi is going to hell because he's a Hindu. So it never became a barrier to me trying to understand people of other faiths or people who didn't have any faith. I think more than anything, how my faith has really shaped my work is that I know the importance of hope. Hope. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I sense that we're at a dangerous place in the country right now, where a lot of people have lost hope, where a lot of people believe that racism is a permanent part of this country, that we can't get over these racial divisions. And hope is a huge theme in Christianity, and hope got me through my childhood. And I looked at my family, I'm like, God, if we can reconcile, if we can reconnect, yes, there's hope. If people can change, a country can change. So the importance of writing stories that give people hope is, I think, also a reflection of my faith.
So I want to stay with this for just a moment. On social media earlier today, I saw a tweet from a person that I follow who gives commentary about social issues. And she said, listen, for a lot of vulnerable people today, when they see someone wearing a cross, that immediately indicates to me this person is not safe to be around. This person wishes me violence. When I read your book More Than I Imagined, and as I'm speaking to you, I am hearing a different Christianity than that unsafe, violent Christianity. How do we get from that branding that says the cross is, and anyone that wears the cross is a fearful, unsafe person? How do we get to the kind of public Christianity that you have experienced and that you're talking about, one where people can be safe in their difference?
Wow, that's a heavy question. I would think we would get that way by showing how we love people. That's the thing that distinguishes us. That's the thing that helped me. And I have to say, that's the thing that really helped my mom. One of the things I point out in the book is that she was an extremely devout Roman Catholic. And so is my Aunt Mary. And her faith helped her get through all those years in a mental institution away from her sons. And Aunt Mary's faith helped her connect with me because she instinctively understood words like grace and forgiveness. And I think there are a lot of people that are really hurting right now and isolated and alone in our country. And maybe it's not as dramatic as what my mom went through. But when you show that side to people, when you show that love and that service, and you're not like condemning them all the time, it's very attractive to people. And look, we need community. That's what the church gave me. I didn't belong anywhere. I didn't belong to Black community, white community, but I found my community in this place that was just very accepting and loving. And I think we can provide that community. And I think we have to. I wrote a story recently where I said, white evangelical churches won't survive if they don't find a way to integrate non-white Christians, because that's the trend in this country. A lot of people aren't going to these churches, but there are a lot of Christians of color who are coming here from the global South. How do you integrate them? You have to show that kind of acceptance too.
A moment ago, you mentioned the word forgiveness, and clearly forgiveness is an important part of a lot of the ways that Christians think about their journey and their way of being in the world. I wonder if you can give me and my listeners one or two examples of how forgiveness has made an impact in your own walk and your own sense of community.
Well, that's a good question. It's really in my book, in my story. Like, I had to find a way to forgive people who wanted nothing to do with me. And I think one of the key moments came, I remember writing this in the book when I was thinking about Aunt Mary. And I remember thinking she had grown up in this all white segregated world where she inherited these racial attitudes. I don't think she consciously decided I'm going to dislike Black people. It was just in the air. She just absorbed it. But that was very little. I had done the same thing. I had grown up in this all Black world and nobody liked white people. And so I absorbed some of that. And I remember saying that what was in her was also in me. So I think part of that kind of being able to see that in her, that I have also experienced that. That helped me forgive her. But I think the big thing was with my grandfather, this man who had, this is a strange part of the story, but for me to stop those type of visits, I had to understand him and see him as a man, as a complex human being. And I had to forgive him instead of just seeing him as this like villain who had tried to hurt my father.
Well, John Blake, I had an intense reaction reading your book More Than I Imagined. There were points where the writing gave me chills. I was in fear for you and your brother at certain points. And there were points where I whooped with joy as you overcame obstacles and found closure and relationship. It is such a well-written book. It brings in so many aspects of that period of life and that part of the United States that I hadn't known so much about. I am so grateful that you had the bravery and the willingness to write this book. But thank you especially for talking about it today with me and my listeners.
Well, thank you, Dave, for those great questions. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking today with John Blake. He's an award-winning CNN journalist. He's been honored by the Associated Press, the Society of Professional Journalists, the American Academy of Religion, the National Association of Black Journalists, and numerous other professional organizations. He's a recipient of the GLAAD Media Award and has spoken at high schools, colleges, symposiums, and in documentaries on race, religion, and politics. Today, we've been talking about his recent book, More Than I Imagined, What a Black Man Discovered About the White Mother He Never Knew.
Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park, here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.